From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, researcher Reggie Jackson talks about the roots of mass incarceration in the United States.
You can't fight a war on drugs unless you build an army first. And we had to set up the mechanism to create all of the ways to fund police, court systems, prison building, all of those things took place over a pretty extended period of time. And most people just aren't aware of that history.
Then cellist Robert Cohen finds creativity in many places, especially when he practices.
It's incredibly creative because it's about exploring all the time. You know, I don't want to play a piece of music the same way I played it before. So now it's all about finding other ways of looking at it.
Plus, actor and singer Mandy Patinkin joins us to talk about his work with refugees and his love of the Midwest. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It's great to have you with us. I'm Bonnie North. More than 2 million people are currently imprisoned in the United States. Although this country has just 4% of the world's population, it accounts for a quarter of the world's prison population. So how did we get here? People point to different pieces of legislation as the main cause for mass incarceration. But researcher Reggie Jackson says it's the result of a complex web of laws and policy decisions that have created this issue. Jackson will give a presentation about the history of mass incarceration tomorrow night at the Shorewood Village Center. But first, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the roots of the problem.
We have to go back to the 1960s, the policies under President Kennedy, President Johnson, and also President Nixon that kind of put the building blocks in place for us to create this massive carceral state that we have right now. And these are things that people just aren't aware of. There's been a lot of work and conversations about mass incarceration. I want people to know more about how the system developed over the course of time, the building blocks to it.
So what were some of the policies coming out of, I think the oldest one you mentioned there was the Kennedy administration, that really gets the ball rolling?
President Kennedy, very early in 1961, started to attack the issue of what was called at that time juvenile delinquency. And so he put pieces in place to begin to involve the police in dealing with so-called juvenile delinquency. And that was really the beginning of creating kind of a space where we adjudicated young people in a way that led to them having a criminal justice record. And then typically people who have contact with the police early on in their lives, who are arrested early on, they're much more likely to end up in prison as adults. And so that was kind of the beginning of the process, this attack on juvenile delinquency that President Kennedy started in 1961.
When we look at juvenile delinquency in particular, you know, we've started to talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, that kids inside of classrooms will get tickets and end up in the juvenile justice system.
Yeah, you know, people think that it's something recent, but it really isn't recent. This is something that started many years ago and developed, laws developed on a federal level and then state levels to really begin to create a system that created the school-to-prison pipeline. There was a law in 1974, the Juvenile Justice Act, in 1974 that really played a really important role, because what it did was it began to create a larger database of so-called juvenile delinquency, and it also put procedures in place not only in our criminal justice system but also in the social network of organizations that were supposed to be there to help people who were dealing with things. And what they did is they intentionally began to collect data on young people who had any contact with the police, whether they were arrested or not. And they created these large databases, and they used those databases and called these young people delinquents, and they started to arrest them for very minor things. But what changed, though, is that there were juvenile delinquents who were black, there were juvenile delinquents who were whites. And what happens is they began to offer these young whites access to programming to help them overcome whatever difficulties they were having, and then began to call them just simply troublesome children, whereas the black children ended up being locked up in juvenile facilities. We started to build juvenile prisons around the country in the mid-1970s, and the majority of the people that ended up in those juvenile prisons were black, and whites simply just didn't get sent to those places in large numbers.
You know, we talked about the fact that a lot of children who end up in these systems also end up in the adult prison population. And as we look at, similarly, the evolution of these policies, how did that track? You know, going from the Kennedy administration moving forward, what are some of the other policies we see?
So Kennedy started, you know, this attack on juvenile delinquency, and then President Johnson started what he called a war on crime. President Nixon continued that war on crime, and then he started a war on drugs that was kind of continued under presidents after that. President Carter really didn't do a whole lot as president around these issues, but President Ronald Reagan really, you know, issued this dramatic call for a war on drugs. And so, you know, it was over the course of a lot of different people who were president, even President Ford. President Ford played a really, really big role in creating the mechanism that led to mass incarceration as well. So as we look back on it, and most Americans aren't aware because, you know, we like to look back in the past and point fingers at specific people, but I tell people that it was Republicans as well as Democrats who were in the White House, Republicans and Democrats who were in Congress, who all created these laws on the federal level, and then the same thing on the state level. Republicans and Democrats all played a role in it. You know, there's been a lot of conversation recently about the crime bill of 1994, people being chastised for signing that, and they're now apologizing and all those things. But this whole pushback, the Republicans blaming the Democrats blaming the Republicans, everybody in some way, shape, or form was responsible for certain things that happened. And we don't realize it. It took a really long time to create the system. It wasn't just something that happened because Ronald Reagan said we're going to have a war on drugs in, you know, the early 1980s. There were building blocks that were set up before that. I argue this point, Joy, is that you can't fight a war on drugs unless you build an army first. And we had to set up the mechanism to create all of the ways to fund police, court systems, prison building. All of those things took place over a pretty extended period of time. And most people just aren't aware of that history.
When we talk about especially the 94 crime bill, I think a lot of people get stuck on this concept of super predators. Mm-hmm. But when you really start to untangle kind of the web of the war on crime or the war on drugs, these are ultimately a war on people. People mm-hmm. commit crimes. Mm-hmm. People do drugs or sell drugs. You talked about the kinds of mechanisms that were set up. What mm-hmm. did those look like for the war on crime?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, when President Johnson issued this war on crime, one of the things that made it possible was a piece of legislation that most Americans have never heard of. To me, the most important legislation that led to mass incarceration was the creation and the signing of a bill in 1965 called the Law Enforcement Assistance Act. And what that bill did was it changed the way law enforcement worked in the country permanently. What it did was, for the first time in American history, it allowed the federal government to be able to work in collaboration with local and state law enforcement. Prior to that, there had never been any collaboration. So it basically opened the door for the federal government to be able to give funds to states and local communities for law enforcement to pay for more police officers, to pay for, you know, hardware for the police officers, to pay for building prisons. That was really the turning point in how we did criminal justice. And one of the things that came out of that, if you look at who was in prison in 1950 versus who was in prison in 1970, you know, people talked a lot about the crime rate increasing through the 50s and 60s, right? But what you find, if you look at the data, is that the number of people in prison actually dropped from 1950 to 1970 in almost every state, a pretty significant drop. And one of the primary reasons that it dropped was in the 1940s and the 1950s, they began to have conversations. People started to talk about the use of mandatory minimum sentences, which had been developed years before that, and how unfair those mandatory minimum sentences were for drug crimes. And the arguments were the same that we hear now, that, you know, these mandatory minimums don't work, they're unfair, all those things. The biggest difference, though, was back in the 50s and the early 60s, the people who were arguing to get rid of those mandatory minimums were arguing because too many white men had been sent to prison because of these mandatory minimums. So they literally, at the federal level, got rid of those mandatory minimums, and a lot of people ended up getting out of prison. And so the prison population was actually going down when we started this war on crime instead of the prison population going up. And then it began to explode and accelerate pretty quickly as we put these new laws into place and more punitive measures. We began to really treat crime in a different way. It became law and order. You know, it was a rhetoric that all politicians use who wanted to be elected, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, whatever. All of them used that law and order kind of language. And a part of it was related to the civil unrest that happened in the 1960s, you know, across the country, ignoring what happened, what caused the civil unrest, which was mainly related to, you know, poverty and feeling oppressed in those communities. They used that as kind of a springboard to say, oh, the country is really dangerous. We need to do something about it. We need to lock these people up. And, of course, it was coded racial language because people knew when people spoke about law and order that they were really talking about black people that were, you know, these people that people considered to be the criminals in the country, and ignoring the fact that in 1970, most of the people in prison in the country were actually white.
Well, and as we move into, you know, end of the 70s, early 80s, and we start to see the war on drugs, a lot of people have pointed to that and compared it to what we're dealing with still now, the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. and how we treated people who were on crack cocaine, mm-hmm. not just people who dealt it, but mm-hmm. People who were just everyday users. Mm-hmm. What did the criminalization of drug addicts look like in the 1980s?
Well, you know, we started to create laws in the 1980s under the Reagan administration with the assistance of Congress to fight a war against drugs. And so, you know, one of the things that happens is that over a long period of time, the federal government has criminalized different drugs. So going back to the early 1900s, they, you know, criminalized cocaine, they criminalized marijuana, criminalized heroin, all these things. And those laws have been on the books for a long time. But what happens in the 1980s is this new form of cocaine comes on the scene. Called crack cocaine. Now, nobody knew anything about crack cocaine as these laws were being written. You know, the first really important law in the war on drugs on the federal level was in 1986, and then there's another one in 1988, and then, of course, the one in 1994. But what happens is we began to put punishments in place. We began to create mandatory minimum sentences. We began to create sentences that are related not to the way that we did it before. So prior to that, people would be arrested and adjudicated and sent to prison, sentenced based on the drugs that they used. But we began to use quantities to determine how long people would go to prison. And so we had these sentencing guidelines that were written based on the quantities of drugs that people were caught with. We created really a law that was very unfair. Even though a majority of people who used crack cocaine and who sold crack cocaine were white, and that's still the case to this day. 66% of lifetime users of crack are white people. But the laws were implemented in such a way that we ignored crack cocaine users in rural communities and small towns and white communities. We just ignored them for the most part because we concentrated all of our efforts on central cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and places of that nature. And so what ends up happening, we began to send people to prison using mandatory minimums. And what we did was we said, well, cocaine, powder cocaine and crack cocaine aren't the same. Crack cocaine is way more dangerous, you know, with all of these stories in Time Magazine and Newsweek about how crack cocaine was, you know, the most dangerous drug ever created. And so it becomes this drug that people become very concerned about. It ends up ruining a lot of people's lives, and there are all of these stories about it. People are talking about it as if they're experts on it, and they don't know anything about it because nobody has done any research on it. It just becomes one of these things where enough people say that it's the most addictive drug known to man, then everybody begins to believe it, even though it's absolutely untrue. And so it was very easy for people to pass this legislation in 1988, which basically said if you're caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine, there's a mandatory minimum 5-year prison sentence. which is the only mandatory minimum sentence for the first time you're convicted. There is no other drug in the country at that time that required a mandatory minimum sentence for a first-time offender. And you needed 500 grams of powder cocaine to get the same mandatory five-year sentence. So you literally created a 100-to-1 ratio. And most people were okay with that because they had heard about how dangerous cocaine was, but they thought that crack cocaine was way more dangerous, not understanding that they're the same chemical. And so you began to have a tremendous number of people arrested for crack cocaine offenses, and most of those people arrested were black. Not only were we arresting people who were selling the drugs, but we were also arresting and incarcerating people who were users. And our prisons began to fill up with people who were drug addicts. And, you know, nowadays we've heard, as you mentioned, the opioid crisis and how many people are addicted to opioids. But we don't see this mass arrests of people who were on opioids. Now we're talking about drug treatment for these people. And so we created a situation where we pointed the finger at the black and Latino community in particular, and we put all of our efforts into fighting drugs in those communities and ignoring it in other communities, particularly the white community. Had we done the same thing in the white communities that we did in the black and Latino communities, I'm sure that white people would have been very upset and would have made sure that those things didn't happen, that they weren't all of these mass arrests of people and people weren't consistently being harassed by the police. Obviously, people were selling drugs, but at the same time, people forget that in the early 80s, prior to this stuff happening, that the economy collapsed, that we had the largest recession since the Great Depression in 1981 and 82, and people were out of work by the millions. The unemployment rate in 1982 reached double digits for the first time since 1941. So there was an economic crisis. People needed to feed themselves. And if this was a way to provide food and shelter for themselves and their families, they were going to take advantage of it. I mean, it's no different than what happened during the Great Depression. People decided, well, listen, if there's no real work, then we'll partake in criminal activity to make money for ourselves. And those things in the 80s in particular began to lead us to have huge disparities in terms of who was in the prisons. And those are things that people are kind of beginning to admit now. President Clinton apologized for being part of this and other people who signed the law in 1994. But nobody has apologized for the laws in 1988 or 1986 or any of the other ones that I talked to you about. Nobody's apologized for those. Those really created the system that we have. And I think what's left out of the conversation about reform that's happening is that, listen, not only do we have 2.2 million people incarcerated on any given day, we also have over 2 million people who work for the criminal justice system on any given day, anywhere from 2.2 to 2.4 million people, depending on the database you look at. So well over 2 million people that are employed as police officers and judges, court clerks, stenographers, prison guards, probation and parole agents. So it's really a system that is self-perpetuating because it employs over 2 million people. To incarcerate 2 million people, we have 2 million people working in the system to make sure that people are incarcerated.
So when we look at reforming this system, what are the ideas out there and what's actually being implemented?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about reform, and there have been a great deal of reform efforts by different states. States are doing different things. So states are getting rid of mandatory minimum sentences. States are getting rid of, like, the three strikes and you're out laws. States are changing the sentencing guidelines for, you know, different crimes. So there's a lot that's being done. Even on the federal level, there have been efforts to change, like, the crack cocaine versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity, which is 100-to-1, has been lowered to 18-to-1. There have been measures on the federal level that have kind of allowed people to get out of prison earlier to kind of backtrack on some of those sentences that were developed in the 80s. But I tell people that those things are slow to happen and that they're not having a huge impact. They are having an impact, though. We are seeing less numbers of blacks in prison. The number of blacks, black men in prison in particular, has been dropping since 2002 when it reached its peak. It's been going down every year since then. The national prison population has decreased primarily because of states like California, which the prisons were so overcrowded that federal judges basically forced them to let people out of prison early because it was just ridiculous overcrowding. There are a lot of efforts here in Wisconsin to talk about reform. There really hasn't been much reform in Wisconsin. There's been reform in a lot of states. You know, a lot of states are, you know, creating best practices that we could follow as a state, but we're choosing not to. And I tell people who are working on the reform efforts that what they don't understand is that they're fighting against a huge system. We don't have a criminal justice system in the United States, Georgia. We literally have over 3,000 criminal justice systems because every county or county equivalent has their own district attorney and their own system in those counties. Then we have the federal system, and then we have the military system as well. So we have all of these different systems that don't always work well together, and reform in one county doesn't apply to the next county. So I've been telling people here in Wisconsin that when we think of the incarceration of people here, and there are over 23,000 people in our prisons currently, the effort to reform the system needs to be a statewide effort, but it also needs to be a countywide effort. We need to look at the counties where a majority of the people are coming from and ask, you know, what's driving it in those communities and fight it at that level.
Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome, Joy.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot for America's Black Holocaust Museum. He's a writer for the Milwaukee Independent and the co-owner of Nurturing Diversity Partners. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and he'll give a presentation about the history of mass incarceration tomorrow night at the Shorewood Village Center at 6:30. You can find a link to the event at WUWM.com. Coming up next, cellist and Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen muses on creativity and some of the unexpected places he finds it. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Every month we talk with cellist Robert Cohen about the life of a touring classical musician. It's a segment that we call On That Note. This month finds Robert recently moved to the Suffolk countryside in England, and in between packing boxes and hooking up utilities, he's thinking about creativity. He says that having a quiet, beautiful space like the one he now has is really important.
I have very powerful memories of practicing my cello at my grandparents' cottage and being sort of in seventh heaven, the sort of solitude, but the somehow the age of the, I think it was the 17th century cottage, and playing my old cello in that surroundings. I used to just get really, I used to practice fantastically well, be really absorbed and amazingly focused and just could practice all day long. And the energy was wonderful. And now I'm here, I'm actually really feeling a very similar thing, that when I'm playing my cello in a kind of 17th century cottage and my cello being made in 1723, there seems to be a certain sort of natural connection between the wood of my instrument and the wood that surrounds me. And I don't know why, it's inspiring, and it gives me a sense of, you know, a greater sense of adventure in the music as I'm practicing. So I am finding, it's very early days, but I'm finding that very exciting, and it's a beautiful feeling. But aside from when I'm practicing, of course, that quietness, when you, the rest of your life is so ridiculously noisy, if you like, and busy and so on, it's definitely seems to give me space to think, which is, I suppose, what I've been looking for so long. And that's allowed me also just in the last few weeks to put my thoughts together for a whole variety of lectures and talks that I've been giving, a whole batch of them recently. And I found that having that kind of flow now and having to put my work, my ideas into words and communicate them in words to people has really inspired me to find better ways of explaining what we do as musicians and better ways of getting giving advice giving guidelines to musicians. And in doing all these lectures, I kind of feel that I'm dealing with a lot of things to do with creativity and to do with well-being and mental health and just understanding really the multitasking that we are so involved in music.
Exactly.
I mean, it just astounds me.
It is astounding, and I'm not anywhere near your level. But you know, I practiced as a kid. I played music. My dad was a bassoonist, and both my brother and I played different instruments. And so, you know, I know from a very, very, very amateur way what that's like to kind of focus and having to coordinate all of those different things. That one of the things that always frustrated me so much was that it felt like the creative piece of making music was somewhere over there, and I couldn't quite get to it because my technique or lack of it was in the way, or, you know, I needed to learn more things, or I didn't have my hands coordinated well enough, and I was still learning how to do that. You've obviously learned how to harness all of those things and yet still have that creative force flow through you. But I found it so frustrating. Do your students find that frustrating?
Well, I think what everybody finds frustrating and it's incredibly hard work is just the number of things that are required just to play a simple scale in music. Because, you know, not only are you dealing with what both hands are doing separately and they're doing different things, all the fine motor controls that are required, then the coordination between your hands, and then of course your entire body, because that's, you know, your energy and your balance and how you move, and all of those things have to be, you know, refined to such a degree, the kind of elite athlete level, in order to just make a reasonable sound. And then on top of all those physical things, there's that kind of, you know, you've got to have stamina to be able to do that, even just for, you know, half an hour, an hour at a time. So that means a kind of fitness. And then, of course, then you're focusing on so many different things. You've got, you know, the quality of the sound, the kind of the character of the sound is decided upon by how physically you move every finger, how you move your body, and the shape of the phrase, you know, the particular musical stresses, all of those sorts of things. And then your understanding of the music and the architecture of the music, and you're having to be so conscious of this while you're trying to play your simple line of music. And then you're thinking, well, what am I thinking about while I'm doing that? And what am I feeling? And then all your kind of expectations of what you'd like and your desires and your kind of worries about, you know, is it going to go well? Isn't it going to go well? I mean, there are just so many things that you're putting on yourself in order to just to play a simple phrase or a simple piece of music really beautifully. I mean, there are so many, you know, you're putting your brain to incredible amount of activity, and that when you're practicing every day or if you're having difficulties, of course, then it can be really easy to get down. I mean, if you're not managing to do all of those things at the same time, then something's going wrong. I mean, things are, you know, it doesn't sound very good, or, you know, which is the worst thing, actually. I think when the sound is bad, especially musicians really hate that. We're kind of practically crying and think how terrible it is and what a disaster we are because one note in the line didn't sound right. You know, we're so critical of ourselves.
Well, and I think what it is too is that it's not what you hear in your head. You know, whatever the music, however it sounds in your head and the way you think it needs to be, getting that to reproduce on whatever instrument you're doing is, of course, the challenge. And trying to match up, as you said, those expectations with what you hear. And so where does creativity come into it? I mean, it may be a very odd question to ask because we think of music as a creative pursuit, and it is. But where does it come in to all of the other parts of it in order to make it sound good?
Well, you know, I feel that there is just a kind of real magical power of music, and that it has such a strong energy and it's so emotional. And if you really can sing the music in your head, if you can feel the music in your body, if you can be a part of the emotional journey and the language of the composer, that starts to kind of take over your body, take over your ideas. And then just hearing the sound that starts to go in that direction, that's inspiring even on a microscopic level. So if you feel in a phrase of music by Johannes Brahms that there is a fabulous romanticism, and you can feel that as you change from one note to the next note, just because of the twist in harmony and what it does inside your stomach, you know, and how it, you know, the frisson from that. When you feel that for a moment, that's like a speck, a moment of in time which inspires you. It pulls you and it makes you feel that you want to go on to the next note and then from that note and so on. And so you suddenly find yourself really deeply involved in the tiniest twists and turns of the musical journey. And of course, you have to let go of all those worries and those kind of technical things that you've got to think about. They have to be able to flow, and you have to be able to let your mind go.
Do you think that practicing in and of itself is creative?
Oh, I feel now, especially at this point in my life, that it's incredibly creative, because it's about exploring all the time. I mean, you know, I don't want to play a piece of music the same way I've played it before. So now it's all about finding other ways of looking at it and finding going deeper into every part of the music. So for me now, practicing is very exciting, and it's a great exploration. And when I make discoveries, of course they're my discoveries, if you like. So I'm given strength and confidence by the fact that I've found something new, and I experiment with it, I work with it. And in that adventure, it makes me feel that I am doing something creative with the music, very, very definitely.
Most of us grew up with the idea that, you know, practice is the work, and you do the work and you put in the time, and then the performance, you know, is the creative part. And I think a lot of people still think that way. But I wonder if we put too much pressure on the performance if we don't also include the practice and the working toward it as part of the whole process.
I think you're absolutely right. I think being creative takes an enormous amount of practice. I don't think that you can just expect to turn it on at a certain moment, especially to turn it on, you know, and you get on the platform when there are so many pressures on you and expectations and you know, the adrenaline and so on. So to be suddenly thinking, oh, now's the moment I have to be creative, I think that's really tough. And I just think that we cannot be good at it because we haven't done it often enough. But definitely the whole question of making mistakes and allowing yourself to make mistakes, I think is vital, actually. It's vital when you experiment that you try things. And when it's wrong, you should somehow think, I've learned so much from that. I'm so pleased to have discovered what is wrong, because that helps me discover, you know, at least rule that out for the next steps. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, that doesn't work. So now let me go in a different direction. And I just really commit to that completely different direction. And if it turns out that that direction is a disaster, or maybe there are just some elements that are okay, but you know you're not going to go down that road again, you have learned something very important in terms of which direction you're going to go in with your creativity. So I think the mistakes are vital, and they actually should be taken as positive ways of moving forward. And we do learn so much from what doesn't work, don't we?
If we allow ourselves to be open to it, because a lot of times in our society, making mistakes is frowned upon. You're not supposed to make mistakes. You're supposed to do it right, whatever right is. And I've often thought that doing it right can be the enemy of creativity. If you're so married to whatever what you think right is, it doesn't allow you to breathe and room for other things. All of the things you were talking about, the discovery, the finding new things to say and to experience within a piece of music. If you're so focused on only playing it, whatever somebody has dictated is the right way, then you never get a chance to experience it that way.
The greatest, you know, names in creativity have always broken the mold completely. They've done something that nobody imagined was possible, whether it's in science or art or whatever. They've done it in a way that is different than other people have thought. No, you can't do it like that. It's that that can't be done. And then they do it that way because they have a mind, an open mind, a creativity that just says, this can be done in a different way, or I can achieve this. And it doesn't matter how hard, how many mistakes I make on the way, it's going to happen in a new way. And then we admire them so enormously.
Yeah, you have to trust and take the leap into the dark.
Definitely.
I'm hoping that your new cottage in the country helps crystallize these ideas even more, and as you're doing your lectures and, of course, the practicing and performing. But as always, it's such a pleasure to talk with you, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry we've run out of time.
I know. I know. Until next month, thank you so much, and we will chat in November.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Internationally renowned cellist and Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen joins us every month for a segment that we call On That Note. You can hear more of our segments together at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then coming up, actor Mandy Patinkin joins us to talk about growing up in the Midwest, his work with refugees, and his Diaries tour, which brings him to Milwaukee tomorrow evening. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Although Mandy Patinkin may be best known for his role as Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride, the performer's life has been characterized less by vengeance and more by his humanitarianism. He's dedicated time to working with refugees and underprivileged Americans, including kids in his hometown, Chicago. Patinkin grew up in the South Shore neighborhood of Chicago, where he first started performing and which he credits in part for his love of music. Patinkin will be in Milwaukee to perform songs from his album Diary tomorrow evening at the Riverside Theater. But first, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone from New York to talk about the album, his work as an activist, and his love of the Midwest.
I feel the Midwest has humility. I feel the Midwest is not arrogant, and it has a humility that I admire.
Yeah, I think this might not be the most, you know, humility kind of common, but I think we think that of ourselves as well.
That's good. It's okay. It's okay to say that.
So, you know, the South Side of Chicago has specifically become kind of code for gun violence, for social ills.
Yeah.
And we hear politicians, not just in the U.S., but there was recently a U.K. politician who brought up, you know, the South Side of Chicago not wanting his neighborhood to become the South Side of Chicago.
I refer to the South Side sometimes to people. I said, you know, the South Side, which are now the killing field. And that was my neighborhood. A few years ago, I took my friend for his 60th birthday. He wanted to take his friends to their hometown so that we could all show him where we grew up. So I brought him to the South Side, and I gave him the tour. And I remember toward the end of it, it was getting darker and darker for us, just in terms of the depressing nature of everywhere we looked. And I said, well, but before we leave, I have to show you the Young Men's Jewish Council Youth Center where I did the plays, because I didn't like school and my mother told me to go there. And that's where I did these plays after school and where I found my life in the theater. And I just need to show it to you. It's also where I went to nursery school. It was a little two-story building on Phillips. So we came around the corner and there was the building. And there were rolls of barbed wire all on the top of the roof of the first story and on all on the second story and around the building. And I lost my my composure for a minute, and I lost my breath, and I just couldn't believe what had happened to this place. And my friend is one of the most liberal people I've ever known in my life, and progressive people, and caring people about everyone. And he said, I don't feel safe here, and I think we should go and not get out of the car, and we should go. And we did go. The next day, we were driven by a car service to the airport from our hotel. And he overheard us talking about things we had done while we'd been in Chicago. And he said, where were you? Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt. He said, but where did you guys go? I said, the South Side, South Shore, where I grew up. He said, you went there by yourselves? I said, yes. He said, you're lucky to be alive in this car right now. I said, why? He said, I'm a cop. Cops won't go there. And he said, you're really lucky to be alive. Now, I didn't feel that kind of threat when I was there, but my friend felt some danger that I was living off of my youth, my childhood, and only seeing more of what I remembered, not what I was in the moment of seeing. So the question isn't what was when I was little or what is now. I think the real question is, how do we change it? And how do we create opportunity for these young people, like I had at the Young Men's Jewish Council Youth Center? There's an organization I support that does after-school programs in the heart of this area to give kids after-school opportunities, just like I had. I want people who are in underprivileged areas and who therefore think it's attractive to be a part of a gang because of lack of other opportunity to have so much opportunity, maybe more opportunity than anywhere else in the world, that they're just overflowing with possibility. So that's how I think it will change. And I don't think it's about more police protection, and I don't think it's about politicians running on how they're going to stop the violence. I think you need to just give the children and the families great opportunity.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about Chicago right now, but the kind of deterioration that you're talking about in the neighborhood that you grew up in is also something that we've seen here in Milwaukee, something that we've seen in a lot of U.S. cities. As somebody who grew up there, you know, 1950s, 1960s, did you see the changes happening? What's happened in that area since you were a kid?
Well, when I was a kid, it was a Jewish-Polish neighborhood, Jews and Catholics and Poles. And we were Polish, too, even though we were Jewish. We were Polish, but there was a group of Catholic kids that I think were also Polish. You know, they didn't think of the Jews as Poles. And then I remember the Jews all started to leave because African Americans moved into the neighborhood. And there were people knocking on doors, you know, looking for possible homes to buy. My father did not leave. My father stayed on the South Side. His business was there. His synagogue was in Hyde Park, and his friends and life were there. So we stayed. I was in the first graduating class of Kenwood High School. There were, I think, 3,000 kids in our graduating class. And I think there were 100 and some Caucasian kids, and everyone else was African American. And I was one of the Caucasian kids. I loved that high school. That high school changed my life. I didn't like school, you know, the classes in school, I mean. But so the only class I did okay in was chorus. And at Kenwood High School, chorus was taught by a woman named Lena McClin. She was this great lady, and it was an all-black chorus, except for me and one other person, I think, that were not black. And it was gospel music, which is probably the best music on the planet. And Lena McClin said to me, this African-American gifted human being, one day when she asked me to sing something, and I used my voice, and then I thought, oh, she wanted me to sing like an opera singer, big and loud, like somebody else just sang. And I immediately started to apologize when I finished. I said, oh, I'm sorry, Miss McClin. I know you want to. She said, no, child. She said, Liz, you listen to Lena. Anybody tells you not to use that voice, that quiet, high voice of yours, you tell them, come talk to Lena. You use that voice wherever you go and wherever you want. And that woman at that moment gave me the confidence to literally use my voice in any way that my voice came out of me. And not, she changed a lot of people's lives.
You know, you really have used your voice in so many different ways. And in a moment, we'll talk about, you know, your musical work, of course. But, you know, something that you're involved in that people may not know, you're involved in a lot of humanitarian work, and you've specifically worked with refugees. You know, how do you view the refugee crisis that the world is currently experiencing?
The refugee crisis, along with the climate crisis, are the crises of our time. There are 70.8 million refugees, people fleeing for their lives, no matter where you go. Refugees are fleeing from persecution, they are fleeing from conflict, and they are fleeing because of climate change. This current administration has chosen to essentially shut the door on refugees and brought the quota down from the standard from all past generations in America. And I'm talking about Republican and Democratic administrations over the decades. The average number that America always took were 95,000 people were welcomed to our country, including, I dare say, your ancestors and mine, and probably everyone reading or listening to these words. And this current administration just brought that number down to 18,000, the lowest number in the history of this moment. So what do we do about it? Well, I ask that everyone approach their representatives and call your local representative. Ask them to co-sponsor what is called the GRACE Act, which allows 95,000 refugees to come to the United States per year. That is the historic and bipartisan average, no matter what. And then what's the other big thing you can do? You don't need to be a celebrity or a journalist or a politician or a wealthy person or a person of privilege. You need to be a human being to help refugees. You need to exercise your humanitarian nature. You need to welcome people. You need to be kind. A little refugee boy from Afghanistan named Farad Nuri said to me when I asked him, what do you want people to know about your situation? He said, I want them to be kind to refugees, not just to me, he said, but to refugees everywhere. They need kindness. They need to be invited into your community, into your home, into your schools, into your living rooms, to your church, your mosque, your synagogue, your temples, your country. They need to not be feared, just like our ancestors needed not to be feared. And these are false fears that are spread for political purposes for people to get elected. There is no need to be afraid of refugees. They are vetted more than almost any other citizen in the world to this country. They're the safest citizens probably that exist in this country. I've learned that through my relationships with people from the intelligence community over my 8-year journey with Homeland and extraordinary relationships that I forged with highly educated people about intelligence, like the top people in the world. And they told me that we are the gold standard in terms of vetting foreigners who come into this country.
You're someone who has been very careful about how you use your voice and very purposeful in the way that you advocate for things. And one of the things, I actually watched an interview with you and Stephen Colbert, and you talked about, you know, just how much you learned from portraying Saul and how much you learned from listening to people. What did that experience teach you?
It taught me many things. The character alone had a nature that I saw in what the writers had given me, that he was quieter than I was, and that he was a listener, and that he had profound empathy. I, too, have empathy, and always have, but I never listened the way Saul Berenson listened. And he taught me to even be kinder than however kind I thought I'd been in the past. And also, the relationship I had to the show gave me a platform globally that I never imagined having. And it happened at the same time that 125,000 refugees were fleeing Syria, going across the Balkan route, trying to have a new beginning in Germany. And the irony of just going to Germany for a new beginning is the polar opposite of what my parents' generation were dealing with, my grandparents' and parents' generation. And that relationship to the refugee community globally has been one of the most profound gifts of my life. To have that kind of perspective and be inspired to not waste a moment of my life because of witnessing how these people have been knocked down and get up and live again. I think the most important thing we need to learn as a human race is to learn to become more comfortable with being uncomfortable and learn to sit with our discomfort and not to fix everything every second. It's okay if things aren't just the way we need them to be. There are people who make do and make wonderful lives out of a lot of things being broken. They make art out of a broken life. And I think we need to be inspired by them, and we need to learn to be more comfortable with our discomfort.
You know, much as your activism has evolved over time, so has your work. You're about to be in Milwaukee for your Diaries tour. How has your work with refugees, how has your work in your community impacted your art?
It's made me not be afraid to sing songs that tell truth and not be afraid to reach for song and words and moments and music that celebrate life more than I've ever allowed myself to celebrate it before. And to be silly, to have fun, but to also be pointed in highlighting truths. I'm a mailman. I'm not the genius who writes these songs. I'm not the gifted person who creates these songs, the words and the music. I'm just the mailman, but I deliver the mail. And what I'm lucky to be able to deliver is the collective body that write these, what I've often referred to as wishes. They've often written these things, these lyrics, these words, this music. They've written what they wished for themselves and for the world at large. And in many cases, these writers wrote what they couldn't attain themselves, but they wished it for themselves and the world. And in many cases, they left it behind for it to be celebrated by the world. And so to be able to learn these wishes, memorize them, musicalize them, sing them, and share them with a community in every theater and concert hall I go to is like being in a refugee camp, hearing the women play the drums and watching them sing and dance and cry all in the same moment. It just is filled with the experience of living and being. And this life is so precious that to waste it and be sarcastic about it and not recognize all the blessings that we've been given is a crime against the humanity within ourselves.
You know, my father used to say that each of us is a rock that sends ripples through generations. And it feels like you are really living in that thought, in those ripples.
Joy, I try. You know, Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine wrote a show that I got to be in called Sunday in the Park with George. And in it, James Lapine wrote the words that I got to repeat every night, often, many times during the course of the play, the musical. And the words were, connect, George, connect. And that single word, connect, is the word of my life. It is the word that I live, to be, to understand, to embody, to not waste or squander, and to reach for, and to risk for. A friend of mine said, if you wake up and you don't take a risk today, don't wake up.
Wise words. Mandy Patinkin, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for joining us here in Milwaukee.
Thank you. Have a wonderful everything.
Mandy Patinkin is an actor and singer who is perhaps best known for his role as Inigo Montoya in The Princess Bride. Patinkin will be in Milwaukee tomorrow evening for a performance at the Riverside Theater. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.